We love our listeners. Mormonland wouldn't be here without you. We started Mormonland to explore the contours and complexities of Latter-day Saint news and culture. Now, Peggy and I would appreciate your input about how we're doing. We've launched a survey just for you, our podcast listeners, to find out how to continue bringing content that you enjoy. The survey link is in our show notes, or if you can't find it, go to bit.ly/Mormonland. That's bit.ly/Mormonland. Filling out the survey will give you an optional entry into our book giveaway, so you'll have the chance to win books picked for you personally by us. 5 minutes of your time could help us create hours of future content. Thanks so much for your help, and thanks for listening. Thanks for joining us today on Mormonland, where we explore news in and about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm managing editor Dave Noyce. I oversee the Salt Lake Tribune's faith coverage. Senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack is on assignment in the Middle East. So I'm joined today by our colleague, Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Welcome, Tamara.
Thanks so much. Excited to be here.
Great.
Although I will say I am no Peggy.
Well, I'm no Peggy too. So we remind our listeners about another way to support Mormonland. Just go to patreon.com with a small donation, you can access transcripts to our podcast and our complete newsletter. Again, that's Patreon, patreon.com/Mormonland. Now for today's show. To say that leaders of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints often talk about religious freedom would be, well, an understatement. It is a common theme from the top apostles on down and appears to be a favorite topic of Dallin H. Oaks, first counselor in the governing First Presidency, and a former Utah Supreme Court justice. Recently, President Camille Johnson, global head of the Children's Primary Organization and herself a high-powered attorney, picked up on the theme as well in an address in Iowa. The church has been calling for a balancing of religious liberty and LGBTQ rights. It succeeded in passing such legislation in Utah and has pushed for similar measures in Arizona and Georgia. It also backs the proposed Fairness for All Act, which a number of prominent LGBTQ and civil rights groups oppose. So why all the attention on this topic? Are religious freedoms really under threat? If so, from where or whom? Is compromise not only possible, but also preferable? Here via Zoom to discuss those questions and more is Sarah Berenger Gordon, a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania and an expert on religious liberty who has written notably about Mormon history. Dr. Gordon, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you. So let me just ask you on a personal front, how did you get interested in this topic, of religious liberty?
I applied to seminary as well as law school when I was finishing college. And I thought it was an either or. Silly me. I became one of a whole generation of people that began crossing professional and disciplinary boundaries. And I wound up training both in seminary and in law school. And of course, the law of church and state became my central focus.
Has that been throughout your academic career pretty much?
It has indeed. And I still have a lot to learn.
Well, let's dig deeper into something. Now, something just came this week to kind of get us rolling on this. Just this week, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom issued its report on nations it accuses of violating religious freedoms. We see the likes of Russia, China, North Korea, Afghanistan, Iran on there. In your view, though, how does the U.S. itself fare on religious freedom?
Well, it's a difficult question, and I have to tell you, I got in a quite a long debate with a BBC reporter about this several months ago, because one thing he said was, nobody really cares about religion in America. And I said, oh, I think we care. And he said, but, you know, church affiliation is going down. There's just not that much interest. A lot of people are disaffiliating from institutional religion. And I said, that is true. And that's often the case at the end of a great awakening. And we have for the past generation lived through a great awakening. I think this is not a pattern that's out of sync with American history. But I also think you're asking the wrong questions about spiritual life, because many people are very spiritually active. And the fact that they don't belong to any one church, they may attend several, or they used to belong to one organization and they're rethinking that. Those are often seeking positions, not positions of rejection. And we could not come to agreement, but I still believe it. I still think religion is very important in American life, even for those who don't have a particularly strong institutional identity. And I do think that we have become more and more adept at recognizing the religious value of multiple different ways of living a spiritually full life.
So one question I had is that, how do the courts define religious liberty today? And how has that changed through the years?
Right. It's such a good question. And I have to say, it became obvious to me how difficult it is to understand what religion is, much less religious freedom or religious liberty. With the birth of the field of religious studies, which really only happened starting in the mid-1960s, I have to tell you that group of scholars has not stopped arguing. They still don't know how to draw the boundaries around what is and isn't religion. We've often found deeply religious import in many secular systems. So the problem is always drawing a line. And whenever you draw a line, people of faith swim over it because it's not neat and it can't be cabined. So I think what we can do best is to aspire to protect all forms of religion that don't harm others. And that's really a harm principle, is one that's very important. And that's one thing we've gone back and forth about. Is coercion necessary to find a violation of religious liberty? Is insult enough? Is failure to accommodate, to alter your school schedule, all different levels. What really counts as a violation of religious liberty? Those are extremely difficult questions, but good ones.
And so along those lines, when you hear Latter-day Saint leaders today talk about religious liberty, what do you understand them to mean?
Well, I have to say, having started working on the law of religion as it affected Latter-day Saints almost 40 years ago now, I can tell you it's really changed. One of the things we see is what we just referred to as high-powered lawyers, right? Very, very high up in church government, and thinking deeply about the role of law. And when I was researching, starting in the mid-1980s, and thinking about how much Brigham Young early on was opposed to legal training and to working with lawyers, did not accept the common law into Utah Territory's governance structures, and so on. I think that church has productively engaged with and come to see itself as a participant in a nationwide legal system, mostly through the Constitution, which they always admired, and more recently through active engagement with legal policy, litigation, and more, which wasn't always common.
So one question, I guess, that still remains in my mind is, what is the subtext? Is what versus when we hear it today, when we hear it, and maybe not even necessarily within LDS leadership, but just more the connotation, the popular connotation of religious liberty. Does that make sense as a question?
It totally does, because it shifts across time. And this is where my training as a historian really helps too. Really over the last generation, it has become more and more common for conservative identified groups to have a deep religious liberty focus. And they've become much more litigious And much more eager to bring impact litigation. And one of the ways to think about this is in connection with groups that were litigating on the other side for a good 30 or 40 years before the advent of these conservative groups. So really it's meeting the liberal separationists on their home turf and engaging with their tools and winning a lot of cases too.
It's interesting, Sally, that you bring up litigation, because Dallin Oaks, whom we referred to in the opening, gave a significant speech at the University of Virginia last year.
I've seen it.
Yes, he called for legislative compromises as opposed to litigation, which was interesting coming from a former Supreme Court justice lawyer. And he wanted balances that, like the one reached in Utah, which has been called the Utah Compromise, one that balances religious freedoms and LGBTQ protections. Do you see this as a good approach to try to seek compromises in legislation as opposed to litigation?
Well, one of the things to sort of fold into an analysis of a talk like that is that in 1990, Justice Scalia wrote an opinion saying that the free exercise will never win a case on its own, the free exercise clause. So the right to religious liberty, he said, if it's a neutral and generally applicable law, you have no grounds to object unless you can bring another important right with you, say, your role as a parent, or freedom of speech. So one of the things that happened as a result of that case, which was called Unemployment Division against Smith and involved peyote rituals in the Native American church, what Scalia said was, go to legislatures, get yourselves protected legislatively. And many legislatures have been very friendly to religious organizations, especially with tax exemption, which county tax assessors really don't like. But what happened after that opinion was handed down is that it politicized religious liberty so much. So we saw the Religious Freedom Restoration Act enacted I think it was 2 years after the opinion in Smith, where Congress tried to walk back this approach that Scalia had announced and which was not considered friendly to, you know, very small minority groups, which would have no chance in the political arena. They passed a legislation in a bipartisan way. And we can talk about the history of what happened afterwards. But really, the politicization of these questions undermined goodwill on both sides. And it's become more and more fraught with partisanship, not so much just different litigation positions, but political positions and people saying that, for example, it's those nasty liberals who want to get in the way of religious liberty, and a liberal saying it's those nasty conservatives who won't recognize, you know, small minority groups in ways that are not productive, definitely not productive. It hasn't worked well, this politicization. So when somebody as smart as Dallin Oaks says it makes sense to calm the waters a bit, that's very important. Does it work? I don't, you know, it certainly hasn't.
Yeah.
But the idea that he, as a steward for Latter-day Saints, is making such an argument, that's a great way to roll back some of the louder calls for, and honestly, demonization of the other side. It's very wearing. And honestly, from a thoughtful lawyer's perspective, it's not just unproductive, it's a waste of time.
It's sort of a natural outgrowth, though, if you're going to take take something to a legislative body out of the course of the Congress or a legislature, you're going to, by extension, politicize it, right?
Exactly. That's exactly true. And what has happened is that many conservative justices, I remember when I used to say, you know, that the biggest enemy of religious liberty in courts is actually Justice Scalia. And they'd say, what? I'd say, read the case. But what's happened is now that the conservative justices are lining up behind reversing that case. Now,
so let me ask you just this. We get this question a lot, especially when a Latter-day Saint leader talks about religious freedom and they'll talk about it being under threat. Yeah. Are religious freedoms under threat in the U.S.?
Certainly not. Well, let me just say religious life is vulnerable. And always is. So there's no such thing as an unthreatened atmosphere. So that I think, but are we under more threat than 150 years ago or 200 years ago? No, definitely not. Things are much better. One of the things that Joseph Smith was most irate about was when he went to Congress in the early 1840s and asked for protection against state actors. Really, he was lynched, which just technically means state officers turned and looked the other way as a mob killed him. And it came to have other meanings in the 20th century, but in the 19th century, he was a classic victim of such things. Most were white. And so one of the things that has made a great difference is that once the federal government got involved in the mid 20th century when it incorporated the First Amendment for the first time, applying it against the states, they began to treat religion in the ways that Joseph Smith had asked them to do, provide federal protection against state violators. So that's been an enormous but not uncomplicated benefit.
So often we hear LGBTQ rights come up and protections in these conversations. Are those threats to religious freedom?
I think that's a really good question. I think it's been inordinately politicized. I have to say, I'm not a fan of the Fairness for All Act. So I just want to make sure, I think it protects institutions, over religious individuals. It's really a friend of the churches. And that's one reason I object to it. But I think if we go back 70 years and substitute LGBTQ for Black, we'd find many, many of the same issues. I do think that when we're talking about civil rights, they often conflict with each other. We should not be surprised that we see deep concern on both sides of this and desire to protect religious people. Do I think that a person who opens their store to the public and then refuses to serve someone who has a perfect right to do what they're doing? I think that's really a complicated question. You know, I think for-profit businesses who want the protection of government have to live with some limits.
What do you think are some of the possible implications of these current legal trends, including that politicization that you were talking about, but also you were talking about the shift in the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
And what do you see these trends as doing and possible implications for institutions like the LDS Church?
That's a great question. And could I twist it a little bit?
By all means.
Okay, thank you. Because one of the things that has happened over the last 35 years or so is that religious groups have gotten a lot richer And one of the things that has happened is that they're now able to raise funds through tax-exempt municipal bonds. And they have many substantial contracts with governments. So they've become clients and beneficiaries of government adoption agencies, shelters. I mean, many, many Catholics, Protestants, Jewish groups. Two-thirds of their budget often comes in through contract revenues. So when we talk about the Catholic Adoption Agency that had a contract with the city of Philadelphia in Fulton against Philadelphia and refused to recommend same-sex parents, we're talking about one of those arms, right? One of those service arms of religious organizations that signs contracts with government. So one of the things I want to get on the table, and just let me add one other fast fact. Just in the first dozen years of when churches were allowed to raise funds through tax-exempt municipal bonds in Southern California, over the first 12 years, the Catholic Church raised $15 billion. So that's a lot. Right? It's cheap money. It's a lot. So we have many organizations doing really well. And one of the things we see is that those organizations are now very willing to litigate. So Fulton against City of Philadelphia was supported by lots of conservative religious groups that are litigious arms, right? All those amicus briefs. But the church decided to litigate, not the individuals. And that's happening all over the place. So I think one of the consequences is that there are really big institutional interests behind a lot of these questions. And so we see a flower shop or a bake shop. But honestly, there's really big money behind these fights. And so one of the consequences is that the stakes rise the more that each individual case has important actors behind it. And I have to say, these litigious groups raise money on that. Like they're operating now to defend actual religious organizations equally, if not more often than the vulnerable individuals. So I think that's one thing that we just haven't focused on, that there are enormous institutions behind these. And one of the things I raised about the Fairness for All Act is that it protects institutional life. And I think that's certainly part of what we want to protect, but we also want to protect religions of one rather than.
It's interesting you bringing up, I wouldn't have thought money being a big issue necessarily, but it is, of course. And we've written extensively about the LDS Church's vast wealth. How does money play into it for the LDS Church?
Oh, that's a great question. It's not an organization that is very forthcoming, but I don't mean to imply that others are. I mean, we learned this about the Catholic Church because so many dioceses went through bankruptcy and quite successfully. I mean, they're very happy they did and learned to love, you know, how to stop, you know, screaming and learn to love the law. You know, I mean, they really got it. But I would say that the church has been a reluctant, has not engaged in the level of service provision that I'm talking about for other religious groups. They tend, in Philadelphia, they built a temple with all cash. Cash. Mm-hmm. They never heard of it. I was amazed.
And they have an office tower there too. Yeah.
Whoa. Yeah. But they did, in order to get permission to build the temple, also had to build a 32-story high-rise apartment building nearby. Right. So they're doing deals with government all the time. So it's fair to say that an organization like the LDS Church brings a lot of money to the table whenever it wants to do something. And that's not a complete answer. I know less, and I've never wanted to like try to pry into secrets. That's not what I do. But I do think it's interesting to think about a church that was so poor for so long, struggled so much, and now has to deal with the fact that, you know, these aren't victims anymore. They're part of what controls the country. Hmm.
So let me return to the federal level debate that's going on. The church is as you said, calling for passage of the Fairness for All Act. Now, many major civil rights groups endorse instead the Equality Act.
Yeah.
What in essence is the difference between the two?
Fairness for All is a deep protection for religious organizations that are really all religion. So, you know, churches, church affiliated organizations. So a church hospital, but not a for-profit group. It'd be interesting to see whether, you know, a not-for-profit church newspaper. But I do think that the groups that oppose this find that it leaves way too many insults and harms unaddressed. I think I agree with them on some of it. But I also think we need to take into account more seriously groups that are themselves new or barely surviving religious organizations, not just the ones that are wealthy enough to start hospitals and gymnasiums. So my own sense is that we need to have a broader definition of what counts as religious.
And what would that look like?
Oh, if only I was in charge of the world.
You're right.
Old Granny Gordon stomping around. I do feel that when someone has invoked all the protections of it, things like incorporation and so on, and open their doors to the public, that has to mean public. And I think this is true on race. I think it's true on religion. We literally cannot turn someone away because they're Muslim. That's just wrong. And I feel the same way. If someone has a legal right to get married, you may be upset about it and you may decide never to make wedding cakes again. I get that. And I don't want to force you to go into the wedding cake business. But if you've opened your door to the public, then I feel you should serve the public.
What do you think this drumbeat of religious freedom is doing to the LDS identity? And how individual members see themselves in this debate?
That's such a good question. I was delighted to participate in the annual Religious Liberty Conference in March. So I've been a little part of it. And that was my first time in Utah in 2.5 years. And one of the things I noticed was how... frayed, if could I put it that way, the observance of mask wearing and immunization and so on has been. And despite the very good efforts of church leaders to keep people safe. So to me, I think the Mormon identity might have changed a little bit recently. And I don't really have a conclusion about that, but I saw it. And I thought, well, I was remembering as I participated in that, and please do shut me up if I go on too long, but as I participated in that conference, I was remembering my dear friend, Jan Shipps. I was driving her to the airport one day, and she said her plane was delayed. And she said, oh, I think I'll give Dallin Oaks a call. And I said, Jan, you can call Dallin Oaks? And she said, watch me. And she opened her cell phone and, hi, Dallin. And she said, you're going to drop me off at the church office building. I'm meeting him for lunch. I was just so impressed. I'm so impressed. But one of the things that that I think happens if we trumpet religious liberty in it, you know, in a dog whistle kind of way, when it is identified sharply with a political perspective, then I think that may draw Mormons into relationships with other organizations that have been more inchoate than they were. The other thing I think, though, is I look back at the 1930s, say, and the strong urging of church leaders that Mormons not vote Democratic. And they get you know, Roosevelt carried Utah the whole time. So I'm not as disturbed. I mean, I really think the jury's out on whether there's anything permanent, but I do think Latter-day Saints have had political differences with their leaders before, and it has not been permanently harmful, if you will, of church authority. So I do feel, though, that LDS identity, it just has more question marks around it a bit for me than it did 3 years ago, say.
One last question, Sally, if I can ask. Is the fear that the church has that BYU may have to accommodate something that, you know, the church owned school that is against their honor code, for instance, or that the church would have to perform same-sex marriages in their temples? I mean, is that an actual legitimate fear?
The latter one is bunk. I got to tell you, that one's pure bunk. And I think most people who raise it know it. The question about universities, for example. So in the early 2000s, there was something called the Solomon Amendment to funding for universities that said if because the Army, so this would have actually maybe even earlier, that might have started in the late 90s, because the Army discriminated against gay people, if they didn't allow the Department of Defense to interview on law school campuses, they'd cut their federal funding. So you see how politicized this has been in the past. And so I don't know whether there would ever be anything that would extend that way to funding for religious universities, which get a lot of money. And there was a case that
federal money too.
Oh yeah. Yes. Yeah. Including through student loan. I mean, you know, there's just this whole ornate structure. So whether BYU might have to modify, I don't know. It would depend. It certainly, there's no political interest that would have them having to do that. The big case that was decided in 1983 by the United States Supreme Court involved Bob Jones University against United States, and the IRS sued to withdraw the tax-exempt status of Bob Jones because it did not admit Black students. During the course of the litigation, and it's an old case, so don't hold me to every detail, but during the course of the litigation, Bob Jones altered its admission standards to allow married Black students, and then allowed unmarried, but people were not allowed to date across color lines by the time the case was decided. And the court held straight on that as between racial discrimination and religious liberty, the rule against racial discrimination wins. And that has become, that case has long been extremely unpopular among evangelicals of all stripes. Bob Jones formally apologized in about 2005 and has its tax exempt status back. They said they were mistaken. But this has come up before.
Interesting. I guess that cuts to the harm element you're talking about too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, Sally Berenger Gordon, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you. And I look forward to hearing more and to welcoming Peggy back.
Yeah, me too. And thanks to Tamara Kemsley.
Oh, you bet.
And to our producer, Chris Samuels. We remind our listeners that they keep up on all the happenings in and about the church by subscribing to the Salt Lake Tribune's free Mormonland newsletter. Just go to sltrib.com to sign up, and we'll talk again next time on Mormonland.